John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks for joining us today. A recent report on NPR said that approximately 22,000 veterans from the Army alone have been discharged since 2009 for misconduct related to mental health issues like PTSD and traumatic brain injury. Coming up this hour on The Kathleen Dunn Show, we're going to talk about legislation that could improve the review board process and help veterans successfully appeal their less than honorable or general discharges if they were the result of mental health disorders related to PTSD or TBI. Two guests on the phone with us this hour on The Kathleen Dunn Show. Steve Acheson is an Army veteran of the Iraq War, who also served as a forward observer in the Army. He is co-owner of Peacefully Organic Produce and CSA, which is the first veteran-led community-supported agriculture. Steve Acheson, welcome to The Kathleen Dunn Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also joining me this afternoon is Alexander McCoy, who served 6 years in the United States Marine Corps, including overseas deployments as an embassy guard in Saudi Arabia, the Honduras, and Germany. He was honorably discharged in 2013 at the rank of sergeant and now attends Columbia University in New York City on the GI Bill. He is also the communications director of U.S. Military Veterans of Columbia University, the largest student veteran organization in the Ivy League. Alexander McCoy, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure to be here.
And to both of you, before we do anything else, I just want to say thank you for your service.
Thank you for your support.
Well, Steve Acheson, let's start with you. 22,000 less than honorable discharges reported by the Army since 2009. Do we have any idea how many of these are related directly to PTSD or traumatic brain injury?
Directly related to PTSD and TBI, I guess I would defer to Alex on the exact statistics. He's kind of more of the numbers guy. I guess from my point of view, I would like to maybe set the stage and talk about how, on a personal level, how I've experienced this issue firsthand.
Please do.
And I'd like to tell the story of basically my best friend, Chris Goldsmith, and how he was separated from the military. Chris and I met pretty much day one of basic training. We pushed each other quite a bit, motivated one another, and ended up graduating number one and number two out of AIT as forward observers. We were stationed at Fort Stewart. Chris was in an infantry unit. I was at a headquarters company. We were both, you know, fast-tracking, getting promoted pretty quickly, making names for ourselves, deployed to Sutter City in 2005. Anyone that follows the war knows this wasn't a very fun time or fun place to be. And Chris, because they weren't dropping a lot of artillery, we were repurposed, both of us, to do different jobs than what we were trained. Chris was essentially a photographer and was tasked with photographing mass graves, you know, close-ups of dead bodies and that kind of thing. And for a 19-year-old, who's ready for that? It was a pretty rough time. We came home in January of 2006, and that's when I really saw behaviors start to change with Chris, particularly outside of work. You know, being the good Wisconsin boy that I am, you know, tried to get him to take a drink or two with me before we deployed, and he refused. He was pretty much straight edge before we left. No drinking, no drugs, no smoking, none of that. And, you know, I started seeing him after we returned from the deployment drinking heavily, probably heavier than anyone else that I was around. And being an active duty Army guy, that's saying a lot. So it was clear he was having problems readjusting. In his work life, he was still fast-tracking. He was actually the first one of our AIT class to reach the rank of sergeant in just over 2 years, which is a very quick promotion. He gained a reputation as being pretty high-speed, pretty dependable, but outside of work, he was self-medicating with alcohol and actually was given a diagnosis of adjustment disorder. Because of all these factors, he actually decided to leave the Army after his initial enlistment. But a couple months before, Chris was set to get out, Bush came on and announced the troop surge and enacted stop-loss orders, which essentially prevented any troop from leaving the military after a certain date if their unit was set to deploy. So Chris was going to be kept in the Army for another almost 2 years past his original date that he was supposed to get out, and was going to be sent on another 15-month deployment back to Iraq. This is when I noticed Chris really beginning to struggle to keep it all together. He was seeking out mental health treatment, which at the time was looked at pretty negatively by most in our unit. Chris was drinking more, reckless behavior escalated, really began affecting his performance at work. As Chris's unit was getting ready to redeploy, he found out he got approved to have some surgery, and he was going to be delayed a couple of weeks so he could recover, and he would rejoin his platoon in Iraq. Well, Chris never made it. The night before he was supposed to deploy, Chris attempted suicide. I was recovering from a 24-hour shift and came home a little bit after midnight and saw that the light was on in his room. So I poked my head in to say goodbye before he was supposed to deploy the next morning. And when I opened the door, I basically saw a shrine of photos, families and friends, and two letters, one to his parents and one to me, basically suicide letters. I read the note and immediately called the MPs. We formed a search party. We found him on a parade field where at Fort Stewart, where a tree was planted for every soldier from our division who had been killed. He was passed out in a pile of fire ants, actually. And we found him there unconscious, rushed into the hospital, and it was discovered that he drank an entire bottle of vodka and downed a handful of Percocets. To me, there was no doubt in my mind that he wanted to die. This was so uncharacteristic of Chris. But he survived. And that's when in my opinion, the real travesty began. His unit, who was already deployed, instead of trying to get Chris, who was one of their model soldiers, to treatment, tried to instead make an example out of him, in my opinion. They threatened him with Article 15s, with UCMJ punishment, which he fought tooth and nail, and actually requested a courts-martial, which prompted his unit to drop the case and instead discharged him under a general discharge. Which, when you get out on anything other than honorable, your access to benefits is extremely reduced. In fact, Chris lost his access to his GI Bill and other VA benefits. These very services that are meant to help veterans when they get out deal with these mental health issues, Chris was no longer eligible for. So through this process, the only job he was able to manage after getting out was to become a pizza boy for his little sister, actually. So you can imagine after becoming a combat veteran and, you know, fast-tracking to sergeant and then getting out suddenly on a general discharge and only being able to find a job as a pizza boy for your little sister was very disheartening for Chris. So that led him down a path of trying to get his discharge upgraded, which is kind of where we're focused now is with the Fairness for Veterans Act. And so the problems that we see, well, Chris is a great example. So the first time you apply to get your discharge upgraded is done in writing, and that was denied. The second is an in-person hearing, and Chris was able to get a pro bono lawyer to fly in myself, three others Chris had served with, including his former commander who he was deployed with. All of us testified in person to the character of Chris's service. Five of us veterans in this room crying, basically, in front of a board of five Fulbright colonels. And of that board, only one had deployed, and that one just happened to be from our unit. And that board ruled four against and one in favor of upgrading Chris to an honorable discharge. And the issue was that it was on the veteran. Currently, as it's written, it's on the veteran to prove that their PTSD or TBI directly attributed to the behaviors that led to their discharge. Well, Chris wasn't diagnosed with PTSD until 2 months after he was released from the military, and that's the justification that the board used to deny his upgrade, was that two-month gap after getting out of the service and being diagnosed. And they said, basically, you know, we don't know what happened in that two-month gap, that you may have gotten PTSD then. And so that's, you know, that process has led Chris on to spearhead this legislation and brought in myself and Alex, who I'll kind of let take over and talk more about the act itself and what we're trying to change.
Well, Alexander McCoy, I'll ask you the question that I first posed to Steve that he deferred to you. The number of less than honorable discharges, and that depending on what year, span of years you use, the number is greater or less. How many of these dishonorable or general discharges do we know of that are that can be traced back to a post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury?
So tens of thousands. The Congress in 2009 mandated, because of this problem, that the military must screen soldiers for PTSD before they discharge them for misconduct. And since 2009, the Army alone screened more than 22,000 combat veterans positively for PTSD. So they were determined that they did have PTSD and that the symptoms of their PTSD were affecting their conduct in ways that were resulting in their discharge, and yet the Army still kicked these people out. We found that the U.S. Army's Judge Advocate General School in 2012 published in their Military Law Review that there's now enough data to show that the military is effectively criminalizing mental illness. And so we know that Chris's story that Steve just related is not unique, that there are tens of thousands of troops who the military is letting slip through the cracks, that we are taking the natural symptoms of their mental illness that they've incurred from their combat experience and characterizing it as misbehavior. And so this is what we're trying to fix. Mm-hmm. The bill that we're supporting would provide a safety net that would catch all the troops who fall through the cracks like Chris did. It would create a new standard for when the troop appeals their discharge. They say that I have received a diagnosis of PTSD, and here are the medical records, and I believe that the diagnosed symptoms of my PTSD were the contributing factor to the reason why I was discharged. The current status quo is that the board does not need to take that seriously. They do not have to review the medical evidence. We found that the appeal boards are spending less than 3 minutes reviewing each case, and this is a problem. So our bill would fix that. It would require them to review the evidence, and it would create a rebuttable presumption that the PTSD contributed to the reason for the discharge. Now, this is not intended to be some kind of blanket amnesty for people who genuinely did something wrong. This is only going to impact service members who did not receive a court-martial hearing, literally had their day in court to prove or not prove misconduct. These are troops that, when they're separated in this way, it is effectively the commander who has broad authority to make this happen. There's no limits on the evidence that they can use. Hearsay is allowed. The commander has control over the proceedings. And so veterans can simply be shuffled out, and especially if they have less than 6 years of service, the appeal is the first time they've really had a chance to step forward and say and make their case. And right now they're guilty until proven innocent, and that's what we want to fix. So the bill would require that the board give the government the mandate to demonstrate that these reasons for the discharge were not the cause of combat trauma or not caused by combat trauma.
I just want to make sure that we're clear here. We've been talking about the Army, and Steve, the story that you told is an Army story. Is this an Army problem, or is this a problem that that extends to all of the services who have had personnel in combat situation? Alexander, maybe you could answer that.
So it's definitely something that spans all the services. And it is something that also spans every generation of veterans. One thing that we've seen is that Vietnam veterans
As PTSD becomes better understood, as we gain greater awareness of the impact of combat trauma on mental health, many Vietnam veterans are coming forward and showing that their service was really honorable and that they were not given a fair shake by the system. And so Vietnam veterans, when they appeal their discharge, they benefit from a memo that was sent out by former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel that applies only to veterans from the Vietnam era. Now, that memo does effectively what our bill does, but only impacts that small demographic of veterans. And what we've seen is the success rate of appeals for the Vietnam veterans went from 4% to more than 60% as a result of that memo. Now, current veterans of Iraq, Afghanistan, the other Gulf Wars, other conflicts, they are faced still with this only 4% success rate because they're not getting the benefit of the guidance that is applying to the Vietnam era veterans.
We're talking about proposed legislation that would fix a problem in the way the military reviews less than honorable discharges. And wondering what you think. Are you a veteran who has a less than honorable discharge that you believe was related to PTSD or TBI? And if so, did you appeal your case? And what was your experience like? How would you like to see the system changed? And what do you think about this this legislation in terms of whether it'll solve the problem or not? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR is the email address. Talk at WPR.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more with Steve Acheson and Alexander McCoy on this issue. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show. This hour, we're talking about proposed legislation that would change the way the military reviews less than honorable discharges. Many, many veterans have received less than honorable discharges for misconduct related to mental health issues like PTSD or medical issues like traumatic brain injury. And the legislation seeks to fix a problem in that review process so that these veterans get a fair hearing. I have two guests on this issue this hour. Steve Acheson is a former Army observer and Iraq War vet. Alexander McCoy served 6 years in the U.S. Marine Corps and is now director of U.S. Military Veterans of Columbia University. Steve Acheson, I'll go back to you for just a moment, because in the story you told, it seems to me that there were a number of points where this issue could have been addressed before the discharge took place. I mean, what about the commanding officers in this case? How much responsibility do they have in terms of taking care of the troops under their command and being aware of what their mental state is, and what's their obligation to do something about it then?
Well, I think, we like to be very careful about, what we put on the commanders in terms of who, the fault, because commanders' job is to maintain combat readiness of their unit. So if they have a troop who's suffering from a mental illness, I mean, their job is, of course they care about their troop, but they also need to have a unit that's ready to deploy at any point in time. So they do need to have the ability to move troops around and bring troops in that are ready to go. But yes, there needs to be another process in place for these soldiers or troops in general that are experiencing mental health issues to go and receive treatment instead of punishment.
And I guess specifically, and Alexander McCoy, I'd like you to weigh in on this too. I mean, if there's going to be a less than honorable discharge at stake here, and then the diagnosis of PTSD comes after the fact, Wouldn't it make some sort of sense to have a military policy, an internal policy in place to try to identify PTSD before it gets to that point and make sure that it's on someone's record so that it could be considered a factor in the kind of discharge they get to begin with?
Yes. So there is now, since 2009, the policy of requiring a screening for PTSD before they can kick someone out with an other than honorable discharge. The problem we're seeing is that even when that screening comes back positive, saying that the troop is suffering from mental illness, that's not being properly taken into account. Fortunately, as more awareness of combat trauma and mental health is pervading out among the commanders and among the public at large, we're seeing less of this problem. But we still need to get justice for the people who fell through the cracks in the past. And this is not the only area where this has been kind of an issue. The Department of Defense recently came out with a report recommending that the Department of Defense review all of the Valor Award medal nominations for the top medals, such as the Service Cross and the Silver Star, for possible upgrades to the Medal of Honor, in part because they realized that early in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, the commanders who were writing these nominations for their troops were underselling their heroism. Because these commanders who were observing this and writing the reports had less experience themselves with actual combat. They'd grown up through the years of peacetime during the Cold War, and Iraq and Afghanistan, for many of them, was their first experience with direct combat operations. And so this is a big reason why we didn't see a living recipient of the Medal of Honor for many, many years into the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. The same logic is true here. We have many commanders who, early in the conflict, were used to enforcing peacetime discipline, and it simply may not have occurred to them to consider the impact of mental health and combat trauma when they were looking at cases that they perceived to be simple misbehavior and petty misconduct. Things like the troop experiencing PTSD and then attempting to self-medicate with alcohol, and then coming to work hungover. Maybe they're experiencing insomnia due to nightmares and they're showing up to work late. Maybe they're being argumentative and getting into conflicts with their fellow troops. This is the kind of petty misconduct that we're talking about, where it establishes a pattern, and then the commander decides that the troop is not adjusting well, is not exhibiting the proper discipline, and they separate the troop from the military in this punitive manner without thinking that this might simply be the manifestation of symptoms of mental illness. So there are all these people who have fallen through the cracks already. And while we still are going to continue fighting to improve the process for the service members who are in uniform now, we need to make sure first that there is a safety net to catch the people who did fall through the cracks already, to allow them to reintegrate into society, to enable them to get back on their feet before it's too late, before they experience all the negative impacts of being ostracized for their discharge. This is a group of individuals who are at high risk of suicide, high risk of homelessness, high risk of unemployment because of the stigma associated with a less than honorable discharge. And that's all the more terrible when it's not a discharge that they deserve. And they're not receiving the care that they needed and the care that they earned through their service.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, that's the number to call to join our discussion this afternoon. Let's take, we've got some callers on the line, still room for you if you'd like to make a call right now. Let's start in Madison, and Kathleen is with us. Kathleen, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, I'm really glad you're on this topic. This is one that's bothered me for years. I was in the Air Force. I was discharged in 1993. I had really bad PTSD, And as a woman, you know, the commander could accept alcohol problems or spousal abuse problems, but as a woman, I went in looking for some kind of counseling because I was feeling suicidal. The fellow that I went in to see, supposedly a mental health guy, immediately began discharge proceedings. And I spent the next couple of months lying and lying and lying because I did not want to get a less than honorable discharge of any sort. And I came really, really close to committing suicide. And the only reason that I got out with an honorable discharge is that I accidentally got pregnant. And everybody around me could see what was going on. And so my master sergeant basically fast-tracked me for a medical discharge, honorable discharge. But that stigma against having any mental illness issues whatsoever, I believe that's got to go because it kills people. It almost killed me, and I know it still kills people who just, they can't go seek help. Maybe the only thing they can do is drink themselves to death. It's really got to change. That was 1993, and it's still going on.
Kathleen, thanks for sharing your story. Steve, Alexander, either one of you want to comment on what Kathleen had to share?
Yeah, I'll comment and just say, Kathleen, just know that you're not alone in this fight and the way that you feel. You know, as we've talked about this issue more and more and brought it more to the public's attention and to legislators' attention, we've been getting contacted by, you know, a number of veterans who have gone through the same thing. And on a personal level, I mean, besides watching what happened to Chris, I was also in charge of a platoon, which was a consolidation. My unit had deployed without me. I had gone through two back surgeries, and I was on what's called rear detachment. And I was in charge of a platoon of basically a consolidation from our brigade of troops that were going through medical issues and discharge proceedings. And so, you know, I got to see firsthand how some people in exactly Kathleen's situation were being treated by their by the system, essentially, and being discharged against their will when really all they want is some help.
Is this in some ways a cultural issue for the military? And I know, Alex, you had talked about, particularly early in the Iraq War, commanders who hadn't been in combat before and were not accustomed to dealing with the effects of combat on troops, you know, having an issue of recognizing what was really going on. But is at least part of this kind of a result of the culture that that the military has built up for itself, and particularly I would think among the Army and the Marine Corps, you know, the boots on the ground, the people who are at the pointy end of the stick, is some of this possibly cultural, and that maybe is what needs to change. Alexander, you first, and then I want to hear Steve on this.
Well, I definitely think that particularly in the combat arms forces, there is rightfully so a culture of endurance and strength, and at least you know, trying your absolute best to push through experiences that for many people would be very overwhelming. And we ask a great deal of our troops, of our soldiers, our Marines, our sailors, our airmen, and they really rise to the occasion, but not everyone has the same experience in combat. Not everyone experiences the things that can cause severe mental illness. Experiencing mental illness is not a weakness, and we need to remind ourselves that while we prize this culture of strength in our military, we still need to be supportive of our fellow service members when they need help. And I think that there are lots of ways that PTSD can manifest that we don't necessarily think about. One area that we've seen is the experience of sexual assault. which, as we know, is a very important issue that needs to be addressed in the military. The units that experience a sexual assault of one of their troops, I know this from my personal experience, it can be very divisive within a unit. People feel like they need to take sides. It can be lots of accusations going back and forth. And there's a culture in the military of viewing a sexual assault within a unit as a failure in leadership by the commander. And so many commanders may feel the temptation to just try and make the problem go away. So meanwhile, you have this troop who has experienced sexual assault and is experiencing a great deal of maybe hostility from even their fellow members of their unit. It's very easy for a service member like that to struggle with that situation and struggle with the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And we need to make sure that the symptoms of post-traumatic stress do not get interpreted as misconduct. If the service member is afraid to go to formation in the morning because their attacker is going to be standing there in formation right next to them, the correct response is not to go after them and saying that they're breaking the rules for missing formation. We need to look deeper and realize there's an underlying issue here and get them the opportunity to continue serving or to get out on their own terms and ensure that justice is done.
Steve Atchison, comment, if you will, on the idea that there's some cultural factors at work here.
Yeah, well, I would totally agree. I mean, coming from the Army side and as a combat arms MOS, as a forward observer, I mean, there's a lot of machoism and bravado and, you know, just like Alex had said, you know, push through and try to hide any weakness. And that's the root cause of these problems that we're seeing today. And especially with in the past before, you know, the 2009 study. Mm-hmm. It is changing, in my opinion, slowly. I think commanders are becoming more aware of the symptoms and are paying more attention to their troops' mental health. But, you know, back when, you know, in 2006, I mean, PTSD was, like, never even talked about in our units. And coming home, if you had issues, it was on you to go and seek out mental health. There was no screenings. And the few screenings that you were going through, I mean, I had people above me telling me, just answer no. Just say no on every question or else you're going to have to go see mental health. And that was the culture back then. Mm-hmm. And I was one of those very few who was answering those questions honestly, like, yes, I feared for my life. Yes, these things happened. Yes, I saw these things. And even after answering these questions honestly, there still was no follow-up to that to make sure that we were doing okay when we came home. So that culture is shifting a little bit, but it starts even sooner, in my opinion. It starts with our culture before we even join the military. We're taught to value human life. We're taught to be kind to people. And then when we join the military, they try to teach us how to kill people. And they don't teach us how to handle that mentally. And so, you know, any 19, 20-year-old kid is going to, you know, if they're any kind of decent human being before they join the military, is going to suffer some residual effects from these situations.
Mm-hmm. Steve Atchison and Alexander McCoy, hang on. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk. Well, we've got a bunch of phone calls to take. I want to try to get to everybody's story, but I also want to go back to the specific legislation that is supposedly going to address this problem of getting fair appeals for these less than honorable discharges. It's called the Fairness for Veterans Act, and I want to go back and review exactly what it is and talk about what its chances are to get through the Congress and become the law of the land. We'll have that discussion. We'll take some more of your calls at 800-642-1234 in just a moment. Steve Atchison and Alexander McCoy are my guests this hour. They're both veterans, and they're in favor of this legislation. We're hearing from them and from you. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to The Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about legislation that would change the review process for appeals of less than honorable discharges from the U.S. military. My guests are Steve Atchison, former Army observer and Iraq War veteran. He's co-owner of the Peacefully Organic Produce and CSA, which is the first veteran-led, community-supported agriculture. And Alexander McCoy, who served 6 years in the United States Marine Corps. He's now the Communication Director of U.S. Military Veterans of Columbia University. Before we get to the specifics of the Fairness for Veterans Act, I want to take a couple of phone calls here. We have people who've been waiting patiently. We'll start in Appleton, where Angie is with us. Angie, thanks for being along today.
Yeah, thank you for letting me speak. I just really want to commend you, the men who are doing this, because this is how it changes. And I think that if you're in a specialized field, even the health care is better. They take care of their men better. This needs to get cleaned up, because a soldier, I am very grateful for the service that you have performed, and it doesn't change. It doesn't change when you need help. You're still the same to me. Your valor is still the same to me. And I just want to say that. Thank you for your service.
Angie, thank you for calling in today. Either one of you want to follow up on what Angie had to say? Otherwise, we can go ahead.
Yeah. So one thing that I hope that this isn't taken the wrong way by the listening audience, but one thing that I will say is that this farm that my partner Steph and I have started, which is focused on veterans reintegration and providing employment for veterans and feeding veterans in our community, she spoke a lot about service and how much that service meant to her. I personally feel like what I'm doing now on this farm and growing healthy organic food for people in my community and reaching out and helping other veterans do the same is far more service to this country and my community than anything that I did while I was deployed. And so this is kind of a full circle what we're trying to do here is veterans taking care of veterans. And that's what Alex and Chris and David and Thomas and I have done in BC in January when we all met to really advocate for this bill. It's veterans taking care of veterans.
Go ahead, Alexander.
And I think it's important to really, point out something that she said that was 100% spot on. This is a grassroots effort. I mean, this is how things change. This is how our democracy is supposed to work. And it's been really heartening to see it actually working this way. We were just five veterans from five different states, got together and studied this issue and realized that there was a need and put together a good idea to fix it, and then went to Congress and said, please do this. And so it's been really, really great to see the support that we're seeing from everyone all over this country, including your listeners and people who are affected by this coming out, and to see that really making a difference in getting something productive through this Congress, which is known for dysfunction and partisan paralysis. So thank you for your support, and I hope that you and everyone else listening here today, you'll contact your members of Congress and tell them to pass the Fairness for Veterans Act.
Well, let's talk about this specifically. Where are we in the process with this legislation? I mean, it has sponsors in the House of Representatives. What's your assessment of where we are in this politically?
So the bill originally was put in the Senate. It was introduced by Senator Gary Peters of Michigan with the support of Senators Tillis and Senator Daines. And we have really put the focus of our efforts to get the House Companion Bill introduced, which we have just a couple weeks ago. The bill is now in the House as well, an identical bill led by Representative Mike Kaufman, Republican from Colorado, with the help of Tim Walz, Democrat, and several other really supportive representatives, Lee Zeldin, Seth Moulton, and others. And so we've been focusing on building more and more support in the House of Representatives and in the Senate to back this up. Right now we have, I believe, 14 or 15 co-sponsors in the House, something like 7 or 8 in the Senate. We're still working to gather more support, and we're focusing on the Armed Services Committee. For those of you who may not be familiar with the legislative process, the steps are going to be that the bill will be voted on by the Armed Services Committee in both the House and the Senate before going to a vote by the entire chamber. Once it is passed by both chambers and they come together and make sure that the wording is identical, that's the point when it would go on to be signed by the president. So we're really focused on first getting it out of the committee, and I'm very optimistic on that. We've seen strong bipartisan support. So far, the co-sponsors, it's been roughly equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans from states all over the country. We've seen very conservative members of Congress and very liberal members of Congress join together on this important issue, something that is very rarely seen. And we've really seen a lot of support from members of Congress who themselves served in uniform. Something like 12 out of our co-sponsors in the House all are military veterans themselves, particularly veterans in the post-9/11 era. Mm-hmm. So I am optimistic, but it's going to take continued work. It's going to take regular people like me and Steve and our listeners back at home calling your representatives and asking them to pass this bill. If we cannot pass it as one standalone bill, our goal will be to get it wrapped up in the big bill that funds the entire military every year, and that's called the National Defense Authorization Act. So that's our kind of plan B. And I'm confident that one way or another, we will get this passed.
Well, it may seem like a kind of a silly question, but who would oppose this?
Well, like many, like any bill that does something substantive, it's going to cost money. And the result, hopefully, is going to be that veterans who were unjustly discharged and lost access to their benefits will have their discharge uprated as a result of this bill and will now, you know, have new access to the benefits that were previously taken away. So that's more people using their GI Bill, more people who are going to be using health care at the Veterans Affairs hospitals. So this can cost money. We're not sure quite how much. The Congressional Budget Office will come back with an estimate, and then we'll go from there. Mm-hmm. I don't think it will be prohibitively large of a price tag. And we're hopeful that this is going to be something that is such common sense, that is something that really ought to be fixed. You know, you don't leave someone slipping through the cracks and being unjustly treated just because it would cost money to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, like I said, we've seen strong support from members of Congress, both who are very liberal and very conservative. And there's many who are kind of waiting to see more of the data come back, to hear what that price tag is going to be and evaluate it, and then decide whether or not to support the bill. And so that's why it's so important that we make sure that they hear from their constituents and understand that this is a priority for their constituents, and that it's worth spending this money to take care of our servicemen and women.
Let's take another phone call. This time we'll go to Eagle River, where Bob is on the line. Bob, hello.
Hello. Actually, I'm from Lac des Flambeaux. Eagle River is a convenient fiction because it's easier to spell. I just wanted to check in. I'm a 66-year-old Vietnam vet, and back, let's see, when I was an undergrad at UW-Madison, I checked with the university hospital, not with the VA, because I was having some real problems just keeping my head above water. And the psychiatrist I talked to at that time said, well, you know, what you're experiencing sounds like what some people are calling PTSD, but I don't believe in that. And so I ended up getting kind of pencil whipped out the door and feeling like a slacker, you know, like I was making something up. And I wonder how many other vets that happened to at that time. At that time, I think PTSD was kind of new science. And it really I think, left some of us holding the bag for quite some time. And, you know, related to that, I'm aware of some vets, one in particular, who ended up in prison because of behavior issues. Mm-hmm. That could have been probably effectively prevented with effective treatment. I wonder if there's anything underway to establish something in the criminal justice system by way of a diminished capacity mitigation defense. I mean, not to give people a free pass to misbehave, but to look at it and say, you know, here's where that came from, and so we're going to look at it a little differently.
Alex, Steve, either one of you want to respond to what Bob had to say?
Yeah. So I think you brought up a really important issue, that there's a hidden cost to this problem, that, you know, maybe we're not spending the money on those veterans' GI Bill or their health care, but we are spending the money when those veterans are struggling to stand on their own feet. They're falling. They're not able to find productive employment. They're struggling with substance abuse. Maybe they're, they're having run-ins with the law. And so, you know, these are the most at-risk populations. When we unfairly kick somebody out who served honorably but just needed some medical help, it starts this downward spiral, and we really pay the price of that as a community. The other thing to address Bob's question, this is not something that is involved in our legislation, but it is a really great initiative that we're seeing in many states. Many states are trying to create veterans treatment courts, which are designed to connect veterans who are in that kind of bad place, who are struggling, with the services that will get them back on their feet. So I would encourage you to look into veterans treatment courts and support the ongoing initiatives with that. And also, I just wanted to quickly throw out that our legislation, the Fairness for Veterans Act, is supported by all the major veteran service organizations, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the Military Officers Association of America, the American Legion, Disabled American Vets, Vietnam Veterans of America, the United Soldiers and Sailors of America. All these organizations have been incredibly supportive and have endorsed our bill, and we appreciate their continued efforts.
Alexander McCoy, we have got just about a minute left, in fact, a little less than that. Just kind of sum up for us what your hopes are for the result of this legislative initiative.
So I hope to see this legislation passed this year, and I'm optimistic that we can do it. But it's going to take the support of all your listeners. It's going to take people calling their members of Congress and telling them to please prioritize this legislation so that we can help these tens of thousands of veterans before it's too late. So I'm optimistic that we will get this passed with the great support of the members of Congress who are already on the bill and the support of the grassroots support that we're seeing. And I'm also hoping to help raise awareness of the issues of mental illness and post-traumatic stress and help people realize that this is not something that should be stigmatized. That these are people who are not broken. They've just experienced something and are experiencing a very natural reaction to what they've seen.
We'll have to leave it there. Steve, Alex, thank you so much for taking time to talk with our listeners this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to Kendra Smith, who produced this hour of programming, and to Chris Molina, who handled on-air production. Dave Potres, thank you for your excellent technical support this afternoon. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back tomorrow on the Ideas Network of WPR.